had launched its new Shepard rocket again days before, and this time it had landed the booster rocket successfully. Video showed the rocket lifting off from the Texas desert, lofting a space capsule on a ballistic arc to the edge of space, and then successfully returning to Earth. The stubby booster slowly approached the desert landing pad on a rocket engine that switched just after it touched the ground. The presentation ended with Bezos, a wide-brimmed hat and reflective sunglasses, popping open a bottle of champagne on the landing pad with his celebrating team. Though it hadn't demonstrated the accomplishment live and in public in the manner of SpaceX, it appeared that Blue Origin had done what Musk had been promising for years, the feat he hoped to demonstrate on his birthday, landing a reusable rocket stage after flight. But what's more, in Musk's eyes, SpaceX had already done what Blue Origin was getting applause for. It had demonstrated vertical takeoff and landing, VTOL, at its own Texas test facility with a prototype rocket called the Grasshopper, though none of those flights ever went higher than a kilometer above the Earth. Musk, unlike Bezos, was a longtime Twitter user and well used to the mores of the platform. Points are given for aggression and for sarcasm. Not quite rarest. SpaceX Grasshopper rocket did 6 orbital flights 3 years ago and is still around. Musk snapped at Bezos directly. Later he tweeted, Jeff may be unaware SpaceX suborbital, vertical takeoff and landing, flight began 2013. Orbital water landing 2014, orbital land landing next. He wasn't done. Credit for first reusable suborbital rocket goes to X-15. Musk wrote, referring to an experimental U.S. Air Force rocket plane developed in the 1960s. And Burt Rutan for commercial, referring to Spaceship One, whose groundbreaking flight had occurred just 9 years earlier. A fellow wealthy rocket enthusiast, the video game pioneer John Carmack, chimed in to mediate all the tweets. Carmack, who made millions creating classic games like Commander Keen, Doom, and Quake, had founded his own rocket company in 2000 to compete for the XPRIZE, only to put it into hibernation in 2013 after several costly failures. Whatever had been done previously on a suborbital scale, he told Musk, Blue Origin's feat was impressive. Among rocket engineers, Blue Origin's takeoff and landing were seen as unique in the world of space. Bezos's team had now demonstrated an original engine design and mastery of the tricky task of controlling a rocket and guiding it back to the ground safely. But they also agreed with Musk's distinction, drawing a line between rockets that fly to the edge of space, that nebulous 100-kilometer line, and those that fly to altitudes higher than 160 kilometers, 100 miles, where objects can remain in space for extended periods. Suborbital rocketry can loft modest science projects and give people a nice view, but orbital rockets can launch lucrative satellite constellations, do exploration work for NASA, and more. Conventional wisdom had it that tourism was not the kind of business that would be sustainable without a billionaire patron. One reason why Musk had instead begun SpaceX with flying cargo to orbit. Getting into orbit requires a vehicle that can generate orders of magnitude more power and force than flying to the edge of space. It's not a matter of getting to a certain height, but of getting to a certain speed. The key is to go so fast that you're moving forward as fast as you're falling down, thereby remaining at a constant height above the Earth. For the lowest orbits, this speed is about 17,500 miles an hour. To reach the edge of space, Blue Origin's rockets needed to go only about 2,125 miles an hour. Relatively speaking, that's about the difference between a fast road cyclist and a sports car. And that was the detail that pained Musk. His rocket had exploded, performing one of the most extreme maneuvers humans can ask of a mechanical device, while Bezos was getting plaudits for child's play and seemingly nobody on Earth could tell the difference. SpaceX would have to show them the difference. The news went out. We're returning to flight in 1 month, and we're landing our first orbital rocket booster. Chapter 2. The Rocket Industrial Complex. I believe we can place men on Mars before 1980. At the same time, we can develop economical space transportation which will permit extensive exploration of the moon. Francis Clauser, California Institute of Technology, 1969. The year 2015 brought moments of tragedy and triumph for Musk and Bezos. But the groundwork for their exercises in rocket capitalism had begun decades earlier, before their space companies formed. In the 90s, PayPal and Amazon began as small startups. But the two entrepreneurs would build them into fast-growing companies that fueled the global economy. At the same time, the U.S. space program was trying, and failing, to gear up for the new century ahead. At Cape Canaveral in 1997, the first satellite launch of the new year would signal change. Its sponsor, the Air Force, looked to private companies to bolster American space power. The Delta II rocket that would fly that morning was a venerable design. Its manufacturer, the veteran but now flagging aerospace firm McDonnell Douglas, had been acquired by Boeing, the aviation giant, in a $13 billion deal announced just weeks before. The transaction united two of the leading makers of fighter jets and airliners. Yet Boeing's purchase of McDonnell and its rocket technology came the same year as a $3 billion acquisition of the space division of Rockwell International, which helped build the space shuttle and the Apollo lunar module. This suggested a bigger vision at the legendary maker of 747s, a fully integrated space division that would offset losses faced by military contractors in the post-Cold War drawdown then underway. Boeing was effectively buying a second chance from the government. Shortly before McDonnell was acquired, the smaller company had won a contract with the Department of Defense that awarded the company $500 million to design a new orbital rocket. Boeing had competed for the contract and lost. Pursuing rocket business made sense to these companies because of the shifting trends in global communications networks. Consider the cargo the Delta II planned to launch that day. The first of 12 planned satellites to replenish and expand the still newfangled Global Positioning System. GPS, as it is known, began in the late 70s as a military enterprise operated by and for the U.S. Air Force. A dozen satellites orbited the Earth, allowing U.S. military units with the correct equipment to triangulate their position on the ground with astonishing accuracy. There was no civilian use of this technology until tragedy mandated it. In 1983, a Korean Air passenger liner accidentally wandered into Soviet airspace and was shot down by a fighter jet, killing 269 innocents on board. In a show of Cold War munificence, Ronald Reagan offered civilian airliners the use of GPS to avoid future deadly navigation errors. By 1989, the Air Force began planning an upgraded set of GPS satellites, and the first consumer GPS receiver was on the market. It was expensive and, in truth, not all that good, since the military had intentionally degraded the accuracy of the civilian system to prevent abuse by criminals or terrorists. Yet the usefulness of the service was becoming clear, as pilots around the world adopted satellite navigation to replace and augment older radar-based techniques. The Clinton administration okayed the continued use of the GPS system, as well as another set of expansion satellites. Vice President Al Gore began a push to expand the transmissions from the system to two new, dedicated civilian channels, effectively creating a digital infrastructure for entrepreneurs to build around. Today, the system is vital to the global economy, with nearly every financial transaction coordinated by GPS timing signals. Arthur C. Clarke had first envisioned satellites creating global communications networks in 1945. As governments demonstrated that the technology had arrived for this futuristic vision, private companies announced plans for their own constellations, for mobile communications, and to broadcast television signals. Rocket companies took note. Beyond GPS, there would be a growing abundance of lucrative cargo to be launched into space. The workers who showed up on launch day that January, then, could only feel as if they were at the beginning of a new leap forward in space commerce. As the countdown moved forward, propulsion engineer Brian Mostel's job was to prepare the rocket for launch, opening and closing valves with push-button electronics as propellant was loaded. He worked with his team from a control room about 600 feet from the launch pad, and the countdown proceeded without issue. This Delta II rocket had one main engine, and, typical of the designs of the time, was strapped with 9 additional solid-fuel rocket boosters to drive the vehicle up into space. Strip charts, paper on easels marked by a mechanical pen, tracked data from the spacecraft. As the engines ignited on time, Mostel strolled into the next room to stand with the launch director and the rest of the team. Console operators were at their stations to track the flight. Alas, it wasn't a long one. Seconds after liftoff, the metal case enclosing one of Delta's solid-fuel rocket boosters cracked. What had been a controlled chemical reaction, launching the rocket by generating more than 1 million pounds of pressure, broke loose. The force tore open the rocket's engines and triggered the vehicle's onboard self-destruct system. "We have an anomaly," the launch announcer said. Amazingly, the upper stages of the rocket were able to ignite and fly free of the initial explosion before their own self-destruct mechanisms were activated. The rocket was barely 1,600 feet above the Earth when it exploded, like a giant fireworks display. Instead of a chrysanthemum of burning paper, it sent enormous pieces of white-hot metallic debris cascading onto the launch center directly below. The fortified concrete blockhouse where Mostel and his colleagues were watching the launch was barely a quarter mile from the launch pad and surrounded by a thick earthen berm. Still, Mostel's boss, a veteran launch director known for his sang-froid, took one look at the monitors, said, "Boys, this is bad," and dove under a computer console. Other engineers followed suit, scrambling for cover. Mostel stood dumbstruck until debris began crashing down around the blockhouse, causing dust to fall from the ceiling and knocking over furniture. He too finally dove for cover as the massive blast wave shook the building. Safe for the moment, thanks to their fortified position amid the conflagration, the 70 people in the launch house quickly realized they had a new problem. A chunk of the rocket had fallen onto the conduit protecting the data cables connected to the blockhouse. As the cables began to burn, acrid smoke from the melting plastic and metal began to penetrate the building. Their fortress, now filling with smoke, threatened to become a tomb as oxygen ran out. Hunkered down and waiting for rescue, they slipped on plastic oxygen masks to extend their air supply. Just as the situation was becoming completely untenable, they heard firefighters banging on the door to escort them to safety. Though Mostel and his colleagues escaped without serious injury, the technicians' vehicles, parked just behind the control center where the blockhouse was located, hadn't been so lucky. Struck by falling debris, Mostel's truck had caught fire. The windows had melted into glass waterfalls that ran down inside the doors. Calling his insurer to report the loss, Mostel couldn't help but deadpan when asked what had happened to his vehicle. "A rocket hit it," he said. The baffled insurance agent repeated the question, and he told her to switch on CNN, which was just breaking into its regular reporting with video of the tremendous explosion. She got the picture. The 20 cars destroyed would cost more than $400,000. a tiny fraction of the cost of replacing the rocket, satellite, and launch pad consumed in the conflagration. This was the first and only total failure of a Delta II rocket in some 50 launches. But it was also the first in a series of failures that would show how optimism about the U.S. space program had been misplaced. The years ahead would throw rocket makers into panic and ultimately force the government to sign off on a $60 billion monopoly. Calamity always comes first. Rocketry, especially developing new rockets, is an extremely fraught and expensive process. Beginning in the late 1950s, the Mercury program, which launched the first American astronauts into space, blew up rockets left and right, sometimes with their future passengers on hand to observe, before engineers worked out the kinks. The average rocket development program delivers its product 27 months late. Because the machinery necessary to deploy millions of pounds of force with precision is so complex, and failures tend to be total, rocket designers traditionally focus on lots of upfront design work to buy down risk and favor approaches that have proven reliable in the past. The Delta II rocket that exploded in January 1997 was derived from the technology behind Cold War nuclear missiles. It had been resurrected only as a result of tragedy. At the dawn of the space shuttle program in the 1970s, the government had aimed to create a one-stop shop for space access. The shuttle orbiter, with its enormous cargo lifting capacity, its ability to convey astronauts, and its versatile maneuvering capabilities, was intended to be the workhorse of the U.S. space program. The vision of the 1979 James Bond thriller Moonraker, which included half a dozen space shuttles conveying reinforcements to Agent 007 as he fought his way through a villain's space lair, wasn't a flight of fancy. It reflected the expectations of the U.S. government. NASA hoped to fly its five-shuttle fleet as often as 20, 30, or even 60 times a year, doing everything from scientific exploration to satellite repair. That dream, deferred by slow technology development, came to an end in 1986. That year's flight of the space shuttle Challenger was intended as a public relations coup that would demonstrate that the United States was bringing not just test pilots and astrophysicists, but also regular citizens into space. A nationwide search for an educator to fly on the mission had selected Krista McCullough, a New Hampshire social studies teacher from among thousands of applicants. She trained for a full year before the flight. Amid great excitement and heightened anticipation, teachers wheeled televisions into classrooms so that schoolchildren around the country could watch the glorious launch of the space shuttle. Instead, they witnessed a space disaster when the vehicle exploded just 1 minute and 13 seconds into its flight. It was the worst NASA accident since a harrowing 1967 episode in which an Apollo space capsule burst into flame during a routine pre-launch test, killing the three astronauts on board. Challenger led to serious reconsideration of U.S. space policy. The loss of the seven astronauts who perished in that venture convinced the top brass at NASA that it was too risky to put humans on every flight into space. That was especially true of those missions intended to launch satellites or space probes with no real human exploration component. Since the shuttle was designed expressly for human spaceflight, this conclusion required the government to find new rockets to launch satellites without people on board. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman, a member of the distinguished panel investigating the disaster, famously demonstrated the tiny flaw that had led to Challenger's loss. He dunked rubber O-rings, used in the construction of the solid fuel rocket booster, into a pitcher of cold water. At lower temperatures, the tight-fitting seals became brittle and stiff, making them likelier to crack under pressure and leak superheated gas. On launch day, temperatures had fallen below freezing, well below acceptable conditions for the rocket boosters. And warnings from the engineers who built the boosters apparently never made it up the chain to NASA management. The experiment illustrated the tiny margin of error in rocketry. Something as simple as a colder-than-average day could mean total failure. The Space Shuttle Orbiter was NASA's first attempt at a reusable spacecraft, so the Challenger investigations also shone a spotlight on the obstacles to launching the same vehicle into orbit multiple times. As NASA engineers worked to ensure that careful inspection and additional refurbishment prevented accidents in the future, the benefits of reusability appeared to decrease. The shuttle's hoped-for ability to fly many times each year did not materialize as NASA had originally foreseen. Rather than a simple turnaround, preparing a used shuttle orbiter for flight required more than 1.2 million different procedures. Not only did this increase spending directly, but the extra time made it difficult to spread the costs of the program over a high rate of flight. Seeing the results of its experiment with reusability, the American Space Brain Trust decided that it needed an expendable rocket if it was going to put satellites into orbit without risking lives or breaking the bank. But there were few existing alternatives when President Reagan told the world that NASA will no longer be in the business of launching private satellites. The shuttle had, in effect, closed out the market for expendable launch vehicles. The promised rate of shuttle flights, as well as government subsidies of $50 million per launch to rent out the shuttle's spacious cargo bay, had convinced most U.S. rocket makers to mothball their operations at the beginning of the decade. It had also, in 1980, helped convince a consortium of European countries to fund Arianespace, a rocket maker that would guarantee their own access to space. Indeed, the U.S. reliance on just one launch vehicle for space access had worried some Americans, especially as delays and cost overruns in the shuttle program mounted. But it was not until Challenger that the government was forced to reckon with the consequences of its policy. The government put all their eggs in one basket. John Garvey, a veteran aerospace engineer who began his career the year of the Challenger disaster and spent the following decades developing rocket technology at McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, and a series of space startups, told me. The shuttle was flawed because it tried to do everything for everybody, and it ended up not satisfying anybody. The government tries to do this every 10 years. With the United States now looking around for expendable rockets to fill the gap, a few reliable defense contractors were called on to resurrect their dormant supply chains. McDonnell Douglas stepped up first, reopening production of the Delta II, a rocket adapted from an intercontinental ballistic missile designed to deliver nuclear weapons across oceans. Its second stage was inherited from the first U.S. rocket to launch satellites in the 50s. And Lockheed Martin put together the Titan IV, a rocket also derived from Cold War ICBMs. These heritage rockets would allow the United States to launch GPS and intelligence-gathering satellites without risking astronauts on routine missions. Yet it quickly became clear that relying on old technology wasn't the answer. In 1994, an Air Force study found that the government was spending $300 million per year on rocket failures and delays. The 1997 Delta II explosion was simply the most visceral example of this trend. The U.S. space community realized that what it needed was a new expendable rocket system. Developing and testing a launch vehicle doesn't come cheap. The government estimated that building on its heritage technology would require an investment of at least $1 billion, whereas an entirely blank slate approach might cost more than $5 billion. Since new was too costly, the government settled on evolved. That is, based on reliable technology rather than starting from scratch to create a new space vehicle. Financing a multi-billion dollar development program, however, didn't really fit into the government's wish list. This plan evolved against the backdrop of vicious budget fights between President Clinton and a Republican Congress that would end with a controversial government shutdown. Still, the government found a way to come up with the money, always the biggest hurdle in the space business. It bet that any new rockets would have plenty of private satellites to launch, creating an incentive for space companies to kick in their own capital to cover some of the development costs. Yet in 1994, defense policy analysts wrote that there are limited opportunities to significantly expand the space launch market. By 1998, however, the government was awarding contracts based on the premise of a booming demand for rocket launches in the private sector. What changed? In a word, the internet. The hunt for a new rocket was also taking place against the backdrop of a bigger revolution, the rise of digital technology. Computers were becoming more of a consumer tool, and the internet more of a public platform. Private sector technologists were starting to become cultural heroes in the way that astronauts had been decades before, combining the steel allure of modern technology with aspirations for a bold new future. In 1994, as the government reevaluated its space technology strategy, Microsoft founders Bill Gates and Paul Allen were dominating the business world with the promise of greater productivity through digital tools. Elon Musk and his brother Kimball, fresh out of college, were renting Silicon Valley office space for their first startup, Zip2, an early attempt to put location information online. Jeff Bezos, meanwhile, was in the process of leaving his work at the Wall Street firm D.E. Shaw to realize an idea for a far-out business that he and his colleagues were calling the Everything Store. Indeed, as the U.S. government was dreaming up the Evolved Expendable Launch Vehicle Program, or EELV, as it would be widely known, Mark Andreessen was delivering the first-ever graphic web browser, Netscape, to the world. Compare the speed of action in these respective institutions. In the 4 years it took the government to finally settle on a strategy to build the new rockets and put pen to paper, Netscape debuted its browser, went public, was purchased by AOL in a $4.2 billion deal, and, in the process, laid the groundwork for an antitrust lawsuit that would end Microsoft's desktop computer monopoly. In that same period, Bezos started Amazon and took the company public in 1997, beginning the future e-commerce giant's path to domination. This fast-moving digital revolution had brought together the two key ingredients in space exploration: huge amounts of capital and plenty of eager dorks. Computers were beginning to dominate the economy completely, at least in the minds of the people in the industry. So why not start hurling them into space? The proliferation of satellite schemes, Teledesic, Iridium, SkyBridge, GlobalStar, implied rising future demands for rockets to get the satellites into orbit. Eyeing these schemes in the mid-90s as they developed proposals for new rockets, Lockheed Martin, McDonnell Douglas, and ultimately Boeing were able to promise vehicles that, by the weird pricing standards of high-explosive space vehicles, were fairly cheap. The architects of the EELV program imagined rockets capable of carrying at least 10 metric tons to low Earth orbit and 5 metric tons to geostationary orbit. They thought the cost of each rocket launch would range between $50 and $150 million in 1994 dollars. Lockheed Martin and McDonnell Douglas won the development contracts at $500 million apiece, and Boeing soon snapped up McDonnell. The next year, 1998, it was Lockheed's turn to see one of its old reliables fail. This time during an attempt to launch a missile early warning satellite from Cape Canaveral. Its trusted Titan IV rocket broke up 41 seconds after liftoff, resulting in total destruction of the satellite and the vehicle. No automobiles were lost this time around. But the satellite and the rocket had together cost $1.3 billion, an enormous waste. Investigators determined that an exposed wire had shorted out the guidance computer, causing a sudden change in direction that the rocket couldn't withstand. Nervous Air Force generals and NASA scientists were now openly fretting about their launch program. The good news was that Boeing was prepared to unveil a new generation of the Delta rocket. It would be the first sign of progress in the new U.S. strategy of outsourcing rocket development to private firms. The Delta III, as it was known, would make its inaugural launch from Cape Canaveral just over 2 weeks later on August 27th. In a surprisingly risky decision, the first flight of this new rocket would carry a real communications satellite for Pan Am Sat, rather than a simulated payload. The new rocket exploded 71 seconds after liftoff. As it flew, the vehicle began shaking as three solid fuel rocket boosters strapped to the main body rocked in unison, a situation its designers hadn't foreseen. Attempting to correct and maintain a straight course, the rocket's guidance computers battled the vibrations valiantly, like a race car driver frantically spinning his steering wheel back and forth to avoid losing control on a tight corner. This worked, but only temporarily. The hydraulic system that steered the rocket ran out of fluid after so many unexpected maneuvers. Like the race car driver simply letting go of the wheel, the rocket lost control. It entered a high-altitude wind shear moving faster than the sound of speed, twisted, and was torn apart. "It's like being punched in the belly," the appropriately named commander at Cape Canaveral, Air Force Brigadier General Randy Starbuck, told reporters. The two enormous aerospace companies shared similar approaches to the engineering business, a kind of total war on problems. Boeing, one former employee told me, tends to attack things with an army of people. It sort of crushes a problem. It's really big, big aerospace. That has benefits, but an organization that relies on sheer size can develop a kind of institutional arteriosclerosis. You can tweak the metrics to make things look green for a long time, but you are pushing the problems into the future, the engineer told me ominously. We would deliver stuff, put it on the rocket, but not test it, knowing that when it was tested at the Cape, problems were going to pop up. But that would be in the future. The people who shipped it could take credit and go home. And if you're smart, you move to another program before that day comes. Less than a year later, in April 1999, two more failures occurred, once again with the Lockheed Titan IV rockets the U.S. Air Force relied on. Two minor mistakes, apparently failures in quality control, led to failed missions. In one case, heat protection tape wrapped around the wrong wires prevented two stages from fully separating. In the other, misprogrammed guidance software caused the second stage to run out of fuel mid-flight. Both failures delivered expensive satellites into useless orbits thousands of miles from their proper destinations. Days later, in May, the Delta III tried to fly for a second time. This time, the new boosters did its job, sending the upper stage of the rocket and its satellite into space. But the engine inside the second stage ruptured during flight due to a poor weld, disabling the rocket and leaving its $145 million satellite payload to become just another piece of space debris circling the Earth. I think this is probably one of the worst times in the launch history of the country, the former head of Air Force Space Command told the Washington Post. Even the old rockets aren't working. And some of the newer rockets aren't working. Chapter 3. The Rocket Monopoly. Space preeminence is essential to being a great power in the next century. USAF Major General James Armour. This 2-year spate of 6 launch failures cost the U.S. government more than $3.5 billion. Beyond the lost taxpayer dollars, the failures showed a worrying lack of innovation. It was not just the old rockets that weren't performing. The new rockets developed to replace them weren't ready to get the job done either. Where the United States had once boasted of dominance in launch, as Gwen Shotwell, SpaceX future president, would put it years later, that capacity was now slipping away. "We owned it in the 80s and the early 90s, and we just let it go," she said. By the year 2000, that beautiful round number that a generation of science fiction authors used as a watchword for a dawning space age, the United States still hadn't solved the problem created by the Challenger disaster 14 years before. Yet the dreams of science fiction readers hardly mattered to the people who controlled the space program. This was no time for the United States, at that moment enjoying a period of global hegemony, to lose its ability to get to orbit. The military desperately wanted access to space, especially in its new role as something of a global police force in the post-Soviet pre-9/11 era. Enforcing a no-fly zone over Saddam Hussein's Iraq, the most active military mission at the time, relied on satellite communications and imaging and positioning technology. Without the ability to maintain a constellation of satellites in orbit, the United States would be in no position to project military force around the world. And by extension, this meant that the global economy hung in the balance as well. Without the ability to secure trade routes and enforce global security pacts, the whole international system could unravel. Still, the private companies had yet to deliver a viable rocket, despite the government's $1 billion investment and years of work. Lockheed Martin's replacement for the Titan IV, a rocket that would be called Atlas V, was still 2 years away from flying. In August 2000, Boeing's Delta III attempted its third flight. This time, engineers loaded the rocket with a dummy payload rather than risk a satellite. Neither the rocket nor its engines burst, but it missed its delivery target by 1,000 miles. Still, Boeing said the test had succeeded in proving the reliability of its systems. But that was the last time the Delta III would fly. Boeing mothballed the program, putting what it had learned into the development of a new, more powerful rocket for the EELV program, the Delta IV. Executives had downplayed the challenges of the work and the business case. "It was sold with the wrong assumptions," Garvey told me. "It was sold as an upgrade from the Delta II, which is so successful, and we know how to do it, and we've been doing it for 35 years. That was an improper way to bill it. You sell it that way because you want your customers and your insurance companies to buy that. It was actually a very high-risk step." Garvey recalls being at the Cape for the first failed Delta III launch. The Boeing team had no real failure response plan. "The marketing guy said that would send the wrong message," Garvey said, describing a fatalistic, "we can't fail" type of mentality. When the rocket broke apart, managers scrambled to respond. They needed to identify the problem, but they forced their team to leave all their notebooks and files in the control room to preserve records. These same engineers were sent back to California to figure out what went wrong without any of their logs. Still, the companies did learn from their costly failures. In 2002, the new EELV rockets, Delta IV and Atlas V, flew successfully for the first time. By 2004, the rockets had flown 6 launches, all successful. Only 2 were for the government, far fewer than the average of 10 per year first envisioned in 1998. But the space business tends to ride a seesaw between 2 priorities: reliability and price. Now that rockets were flying, The seesaw tipped back the other way. Price was going to be the next problem. Boeing and Lockheed executives came to the Pentagon, hat in hand, to complain that they couldn't afford to sell their new rockets at the price they had agreed on. The government's whole plan had relied on being a secondary user of the new rockets, with a robust commercial space industry paying down the costs of development. But that market had simply not materialized. The biggest, most attractive satellite plays, Iridium, Globalstar, Inmarsat, and Teledesic, had all gone bankrupt at the turn of the century as the dot-com bubble popped and Wall Street balked at capital-intensive technology plays. The business climate for satellite communications was still going from bad to worse. Growing cell phone penetration presented a cheaper, more effective alternative to the bulky and often balky satellite phone. Undersea fiber optic cables ate into the business of providing international communications links from space. In another unenforced error, protectionist rules put in place by Congress in 1999, which were intended to keep U.S. technology from leaking to the Chinese and bolster the domestic launch industry, had the opposite effect. The European satellite industry blossomed, which in turn boasted demand for European rockets. American firms turned to government-subsidized rockets built in Europe, Russia, and China to fly their birds. For example, the current satellite constellation behind DirecTV, one of the most successful space businesses in the United States, was launched completely abroad. Soon there was little in the United States for anyone to launch but government satellites, which left the two big rocket makers hanging out to dry. If you price for high rates and you only realize low rates, you're losing money hand over fist. George Sowers, then a Lockheed engineer working on the Atlas V rocket, says. That's what happens to both Boeing and Lockheed. Now the rocket makers said they needed to raise prices, or they wouldn't be able to stay in the business at all. Government auditors estimated that the lack of a commercial market would add nearly $8 billion to the cost of the EELV rocket program. With other factors included, the expected cost overage added up to more than $13 billion, more than 70% over budget. In 2004, this huge increase triggered a legal tripwire designed to prevent out-of-control government spending, which required Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to officially certify to Congress that the program was vital to national security. He did. The Defense Department still claimed that the program was successful, delivering 50% cost reductions from the older launcher families. Worryingly, the auditors dryly reported that they were unable to verify the statements or projections. The EELV program had been conceived a decade before this, but its rockets were hardly proven. In fact, government engineers were fretting about excessive flight vibrations in both vehicles that threatened catastrophic failures. But the military had little choice but to accede to the rocket company's demands. The U.S. military needed access to space, and it had already sunk a huge amount of money into an effort that had yet to deliver any tangible results beyond two launches. The first solution proposed was a 2004 modification to the contract so that neither provider would go into a death spiral of trying to be competitive or face extinction. Besides paying a fixed price fee for every rocket bought to launch U.S. satellites, the government would also begin delivering annual cost-plus payments, essentially a guaranteed profit for the two contractors to pay for launch site and factory facility depreciation and amortization, including production tooling, lease costs, launch and range operations, mission integration and assurance, special studies, program management and systems engineering, training, supplier readiness, and transportation. The initial estimate for each company's costs, without the profit component, was $300 to $360 million annually. But this plus up was not enough. After a few years of hemorrhaging, both companies told the government, "Unless something changes, we're done," Sowers explains. The solution that was cooked up in the smoke-filled rooms was, well, you know, "We don't want one or the other of you to pull out. We kind of like the idea of two independent systems. Let's keep them both and put them under one tent." Thus was born the Great Rocket Monopoly, United Launch Alliance. The idea was simple: to create a joint venture out of the launch divisions of Boeing and Lockheed so that they could find efficiencies of scale and share facilities and personnel. At the same time, it was also a surprise. The companies were longtime rivals. "I hated the idea at first," Sowers says. "I was part of the Atlas program. We were fierce competitors with Delta. We were going to win, damn it." In the years prior to the merger, Boeing had actually been punished by the government for violating trade secret rules when one recently hired engineer was discovered with some 25,000 pages of internal Lockheed documents stacked in his cubicle. The inside information would have improved Boeing's ability to bid against them on rocket launches. The Air Force punished Boeing by giving 7 of its launches, worth $1 billion, to Lockheed in 2003. Litigation and criminal investigations continued into 2005, which may have greased the wheels for a merger to put the whole fracas to rest. Both companies were, in financial terms, laying on the ground bleeding, says Sowers, and had to take action. The only problem, technically, monopolies are illegal. As soon as Boeing and Lockheed announced their plan, the Federal Trade Commission sued to block the merger. The resultant legal thicket was cut down only because the military went to bat for the companies, claiming it was their only way into space. Even so, the Undersecretary of Defense, Kenneth Craig, didn't mince words about what this meant for the U.S. space program. "The most negative view of the creation of ULA is that it will almost certainly have an adverse effect on competition, including higher prices over the long term, as well as a diminution in innovation and responsiveness. Although the parties assert that the joint venture would generate significant savings for the Department of Defense, our careful review of those savings leads us to conclude that the cost savings, while attractive, are not adequate to support the loss of competition." But none of that ultimately mattered, Craig concluded, telling regulators that the U.S. can no longer protect national security without space. He cited one figure during the 1991 U.S. invasion of Kuwait and Iraq. 9% of U.S. munitions were precision-guided by satellite. By the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, 67% were. This mattered for pilot safety, since a target that took 8 sorties to destroy during the first Gulf War now required just one. The FTC would ultimately allow the merger, with a few conditions, mostly designed to ensure that ULA didn't give special treatment to its parent companies, which also built much of the space hardware that flew on those rockets. The Department of Defense promised that new entrants would get a chance to compete for contracts each year, but didn't release the criteria needed for that competition for another 4 years. ULA remains divisive to this day. Its advocates point to its sterling launch record, with few failures, that put national security satellites into space on time. The Atlas V has arguably never failed, having logged more than 80 launches, while the Delta IV has suffered only a handful of partial failures. But launch prices continued to rise, with little increase in performance to show for it. ULA rockets still cost hundreds of millions of dollars more than those from European, Chinese, and Russian competitors. At an average cost of around $400 million a launch, ULA's rockets aren't much cheaper than the heritage systems they were designed to replace, though they were considerably more effective. And ULA continues to receive its annual subsidy, a cost-plus payment for maintaining its infrastructure, which is projected to surpass $1 billion in 2018. This was perfectly fine for Boeing and Lockheed, Sowers told me. They were done with the high-risk commercial launch business. They wanted the safety and financial security of cost-plus. That financial security was real. Though the two military-industrial giants do not release ULA's earnings, disclosures suggest the companies pulled more than $3 billion out of the joint venture in the first 10 years of its existence. This didn't represent a huge share of either company's earnings, but the joint venture was in effect a cash cow that provided constant annual returns without the need for much spending on research and development, or worry about the competition. In the end, the U.S. military got the guaranteed access to space that it wanted, but the space program itself was stagnant. The government offered little incentive for ULA to become more efficient, and the organization saw little reason to compete for private launches or to develop new technology. Even as the pain brought by the end of the dot-com bubble dissipated, and tech investors looked anew at the space business, rising launch costs meant that anyone with a plan to make money flying a satellite looked abroad or simply shelved their idea. Even at NASA, scientists plotting research missions in the solar system and beyond knew that high launch costs would be a limiting factor with every proposal. These consequences were easy to foresee, but the creation of a monopoly that commanded $32 billion in public spending and, in such a high-tech industry, received little attention. At the time, the national security debate was focused on the deteriorating war in Iraq. The public generally had little exposure to the rocket business. Its products are sold to governments or other businesses, so there was no populist outrage against big business. But what about Congress, which is always keeping an eye on the country's purse strings? Well, of course, there are many kinds of purse strings. Boeing and Lockheed Martin, having worked for the government in various forms for more than 75 years each, knew which strings to pull. In 2006, as their merger proposal was under review by the government, Boeing spent more than $9 million and Lockheed more than $10 million hiring DC influence peddlers to smooth their path to regulatory approval. The two companies also gave a combined $4 million to candidates running for election that year. Perhaps most important, the company's industrial footprint, with major manufacturing facilities in states like Alabama, Florida, Colorado, and California, gave them privileged entree to those members of Congress who weren't eager to see hundreds or even thousands of good-paying, high-tech jobs disappear. The monopoly that bailed out the U.S. rocket was sealed largely behind closed doors. But there was one organization that protested the deal with special vigor. A little-known rocket company founded just 3 years before by Elon Musk, who was now a bona fide dot-com millionaire because he had sold two of his companies, dodging the bottom of the tech bubble. SpaceX had yet to launch a rocket, but it had announced a plan to develop an EELV-class rocket to be called the Falcon 9, which would compete with Boeing and Lockheed for government contracts. The company's attorney sent a protest letter to the FTC while the ULA merger was under review, calling its justification for the merger total bunk and demanding that it require ULA to give up its cost-plus subsidies and compete for launches by disclosing the total cost of its work. The company also asked that the Air Force stop allocating launches in 5-year block buys, which could effectively lock SpaceX out of the national security market for years, and instead require competitive bidding on each flight. Nebulous claims regarding national security appear to trump concerns about the effects on competition, even though competition is critical to promoting innovation, which is critical to protecting national security on a continuing basis. SpaceX's counsel wrote to the commissioners, accusing them of largely ignoring the harms that will be done to competition in the broader U.S. launch services industry if this proposed merger to monopoly proceeds. This kind of protest was characteristic of Musk's approach to business, a mixture of principle and opportunism, a man astride a high horse, asking for a dollar. Sound merger enforcement is an essential component of our free enterprise system, benefiting the competitiveness of American firms and the welfare of American consumers, the letter concluded, in high dudgeon. Competition will lead to more innovation and superior products, and ultimately is the best method of protecting national security. The FTC wasn't impressed, or perhaps it missed the point. It noted that since Boeing and Lockheed are not cost competitive with the market leaders, it therefore appears that there is no potential for consumer harm in the commercial launch services market. Without dwelling on the implications of handing an uncompetitive venture a monopoly. The regulators declined to take up any of the fledgling space company's ideas for a fairer deal. Indeed, it had largely written off SpaceX, as the company was popularly known, and anyone else trying to build new rockets in the United States. Successful new entry into the relevant markets is unlikely to occur in the foreseeable future, the FTC concluded. A government-mandated study of the launch market published by the RAND Corporation a year later was similarly skeptical. The evaluation of Falcon 9 at this time presents an unclear picture. The lack of launch experience raises questions about the validity of the available launch prices and makes an objective evaluation of the actual costs of this new vehicle extremely difficult. Now, these evaluators weren't necessarily being unfair. For starters, no new company had ever broken into the orbital launch market. Every previous rocket had been, in some sense, designed by governments for governments. They had just watched two of the most successful aerospace companies in the world struggle for a decade to create new rockets, with government backing. And still, they did not have a viable business. And by the end of 2006, SpaceX had tried to fly only one small rocket, which had exploded almost immediately due to a fuel leak. The new company's charge against the union of the two behemoth contractors was a mouse squeaking at an elephant. Still, the aerospace industry is a small world, and word was creeping out that SpaceX was attracting the kind of top engineers who got bored at the major aerospace firms. Integrating other people's technologies, as one early employee put it to me. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, the military's venture fund for breakthrough technology, which had invested in the early internet, was intrigued by the company's plans and mulling a contract over. And Musk, enveloped in the mystique of Silicon Valley, had put $100 million of his own money on the line. I was sounding the alarm on SpaceX long before it was really anybody in the C-suites that was listening, Sowers told me. One day, Sowers strolled into a board meeting sporting a SpaceX hat picked up at a trade conference. There was a lot of snickers and skepticism and, yeah, we've seen this before. Who's this Elon Musk guy? He can never do what we do. Chapter 4. The Internet Guy. Life needs to be more than just solving problems every day. You need to wake up and be excited about the future and be inspired. Elon Musk. The crowds waiting to get into the speech pushed against the doors, groups of students and their chaperones milling through the tumult, Young engineers, ready to sit in the front row and witness their hero. Older scientists prepared to shake their heads. There's no conference of engineers, astrophysicists, or technologists that doesn't want a keynote from Elon Musk, the rock star of dorks, whose ambition knows no bounds. At an international space conference in 2016, thousands of attendees literally stampeded into a room to hear Musk describe his plans for multiplanetary civilization.